eyes like espresso when I'm feeling a buzz. She got eyes, yeah, she got eyes like a deep espresso.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio wouldn't be here without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our spring membership drive, taking place now through May 25th. Your contribution goes towards postmodern, avant-garde, alternative radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
Tune in every second and fourth Saturday night, midnight to 3 a.m. Sounds unsound. Sounds unsound. Sounds unsound. Only on KBOO.
Sound.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, right now, KBOO is in the middle of our spring membership drive. KBOO is a commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Help us reach our $60,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give. Or you can text the letters KBOO to the number 44321. And we thank you for your support. Well, we have a fascinating show today, and it's all about this crazy time that we're living through. We are living in what's called the information age, but the more information we're bombarded with, the less life seems to make sense. Now, with the totality of human knowledge seemingly just a click away, shouldn't we all be in a little more control of our own minds and our own happiness? Au contraire, instead, there is a cornucopia of illogical behaviors and collective irrationalities in the culture at large and in our own lives, known as cognitive biases. And according to today's guest, our brains are overloaded with a constant stream of information that stokes our innate tendency to believe conspiracy theories and other wild concepts. Our guest is Amanda Montell, author of the book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality. Amanda is a writer and linguist from Baltimore. She's the author of the acclaimed books, Word Slut and Cultish. Alongside the publication of The Age of Magical Overthinking in April 2024, she is launching a new podcast, Magical Overthinkers. The creator and host of the hit podcast Sounds Like a Cult, Montell's writing has appeared in the New York Times, Marie Claire, Cosmopolitan, and more. She holds a degree in linguistics from NYU and lives in Los Angeles with her partner, Plants and Pets. Hello, Amanda, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you know, in the title of your book, you've coined a great meme, magical overthinking. And I want to start by asking about the meaning of both terms, magical thinking and overthinking.
Sure. Well, magical thinking all on its own is a sort of age-old cognitive quirk among us humans. It describes our tendency to believe that our internal thoughts and feelings can affect external events. And magical thinking tends to spike during times of crisis or unpredictability. It helps us feel like we can regain some agency over our lives. It's a bit of a coping mechanism. And It can be really helpful and harmless, but overthinking feels distinct to the modern age, a product of this time when, as you mentioned, we are overloaded with a glut of information coming from so many different sources, and that in combination with mass loneliness and a sort of capitalistic pressure to know everything under the sun is really clashing with our innate superstitions and mysticisms as human beings. And that combination is what I'm referring to as magical overthinking.
Well, it's a great phrase, and it certainly describes what's going on. You write that our minds have been fooling themselves since the dawn of human decision making. Can you speak to that?
Sure. Well, the amount of information from the natural world alone was always too much for the human mind to process. We are not perfectly rational. We are not robots. We are not computers. We are rather what a behavioral economist might describe as resource rational. We make decisions making the best of our limited time and cognitive resources and memory storage. So in, you know, ancient human history, clocking the precise size and shape of every twig and leaf in order to understand it perfectly would have taken too much time, too much memory storage. So we ended up developing these psychological shortcuts to make sense of the world enough to survive it. The problem is that our culture has really outrun our cognitive shortcuts, and we're still applying them to much more but we're doing that without noticing. And I sort of argue throughout this book that that, you know, clash between the ways that we've always naturally made decisions and the culture that we've constructed is causing a great deal of existential pain.
For sure. You know, I wrote a book called Intuitive Intelligence, which is all about decision making. And I posit that it's the most crucial thing that humans do. It's the highest leverage human skill. But man, has it gotten harder with all of this crazy flood of information. You know, why? So humans develop cognitive biases. It's kind of a shortcut to improve our odds of survival. Can you give an example of how that can be a good thing?
Sure. And I also want to, of course, credit the behavioral economics duo Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky for coining the phrase cognitive bias in the 70s. And hundreds of cognitive biases have been described over the years. In this book, I focus on my sort of favorite 11, the 11 that I thought felt most urgent and relevant and could certainly apply to my own life. So one example, it's the first cognitive bias that I cover in the book, is called the halo effect. And it describes our tendency to admire one quality in a person and then jump to the conclusion that they must be perfect overall. So we admire a pop star's music and we jump to the conclusion that this pop star must be educated, worldly, that maybe they align politically with us, or say, you know, we enjoy an influencer's style, their fashion sense. We might jump to the conclusion that they are, you know, updated on current events, as updated as they are on style trends. And these expectations that are based on little evidence are responsible, in my view, for so many of the cycles of intense celebrity worship and dethronement that we're seeing in society. But the halo effect has an adaptive purpose. You know, imagine living 20,000 years ago in a small community. You might clock someone in your tribe with big muscles and intact teeth, and you might jump to the conclusion that they were a skilled hunter or had avoided disfigurement from battle and were thus a capable fighter, aka someone that you would want to align with for survival purposes. But we're now sort of displacing those conclusion jumping methods onto these modern parasocial relationships with celebrities who we've come to perceive not just entertainers but as savior figures. And this dynamic is proving sort of painful and destructive at times.
Yeah, for sure. You know, cognitive biases, this shortcut, it seems to me that there's probably some relationship to our need to be right. You know, we're kind of addicted to being right about things, and that there's this cycle that biases are embedded with this psychological dynamic. We just have this strong need to believe strongly in stuff and believe that we're right. Do you think that's true?
I certainly think that's true. Yeah, I think life as a human on Earth is fundamentally confounding. I think the answers to the biggest questions, why are we here? Where are we going? What is this all for? What is our purpose? Humans have been fiending after those answers for a long time, but it doesn't feel good to have to stomach that sense of cognitive dissonance, that sense of irresolution. So we tend to, you know, cherry pick data to confirm our existing worldview, or we tend to behave overconfidently as a way to boost morale, or to, you know, build our community, because we humans thrive so much better in groups than we do all on their own, all at the expense of, you know, critical thinking sometimes. But yeah, I think the fact that life on Earth is so confusing and the problems that we're tasked with confronting every day are increasingly cerebral and sometimes psychologically stressful, that need to be right and to feel like life is predictable and manageable, and the fact that life only kind of seems to be getting less predictable and less manageable in certain ways, that is a clash that I will certainly be contending with for the rest of my life.
Oh, I think all of us, for sure. So how is it that natural selection, as you put it, favored a paranoid mindset?
Sure. Okay. That is an argument that I make in the second chapter of the book, which confronts a cognitive bias that will fascinate me forever, called proportionality bias, which describes our proclivity to think that big events or even big feelings must have had a big cause. And this is the cognitive bias powering many sinister conspiracy theories. You know, imagine a pandemic. Oh, not so hard to imagine. The pandemic that we are, in a way, still living through every day. It's such, you know, an immense calamity. We think that could not have just been the product of a bunch of small random misfortunes. A government must have engineered it on purpose. That's the only way that something this big could make proportional sense. Or, you know, another example of a conspiracy theory is, you know, Princess Diana passed away in this car accident. That could not have been an accident. The only way that that makes proportional sense is if the royal family killed her on purpose. So it is this misattribution of cause and effect that we make. And yes, there is a sort of evolutionary backstory to it. We adapted for a world filled with hostile intentions. You know, a conspiracy theory mindset is this sort of assumption that there is a kind of human-like intentionality behind things. And I think anyone who's ever made a larger-than-life association between cause and effect that weren't necessarily related might have a pinch of conspiracy theorist in them. It comes down to, like, you know, when your phone isn't working or your car won't start and you think, why are you doing this to me? That is, in a way, a sort of conspiratorial mindset. You think that, you know, your phone is conspiring against you, or the universe is conspiring against you or for you. And the reason why that chapter has the title, I Swear I Manifested This, is because I sort of argue in that chapter that these modern spikes in adoration for manifestation gurus that might emerge in online spaces like Instagram and TikTok, that is a sort of conspiracy theory of its own, these ideas of manifestation, that you can sort of vision board your way to success and wealth and love and all these things. And sometimes that's, you know, there is underlying truth to that. Your mindset certainly can influence outcomes in important ways. But in today's society, a lot of people are harnessing that mentality in an absolute way and really seizing our proportionality bias to use it against us.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's sort of like, to me, it's just amazing to think. I mean, you talk about how you were a conspiracy theorist at least once. The universe is out to get me was a thought that you had as a child or at some point in your development. And I had that too. You know, it's sort of like I thought, oh, yeah, I'm not making the team because God is mad at me. And God's
exactly.
Mad because I'm not good enough. I've been sinning, and I've been, you know, and so it must be that. And so but you can attribute things to an almighty God, but the idea of attributing things to the government on this massive scale, like 80 governments in the world decided to conspire and start the pandemic at the same time, and it's just ridiculous. The government is not very efficient at doing it, much of anything. That one's a little bit absurd.
That's a good point.
But okay, so you know, it's like you say, we can't seem to rest until we find some intentional force either to fault for our misery or credit for our success. And the greater the effect, the greater the we desire the cause to be. It's just like we have this need. We have this need to understand in the face, and now we live with all this uncertainty. It's like this need is more powerful than ever. And that explains the what you call the confirmation bias is a very well-known bias that you bring up quite a bit in the book. You know, I think that one, you know, bears some explanations. So can you speak to that?
Of course, yeah. Confirmation bias was, I believe, the first cognitive bias that I ever came across, became familiar with. It gets a lot of play in headlines, especially in discussing politics and things like that, or even science. But yeah, it describes this tendency to seek out and identify and remember only information that validates what we already believe, while ignoring, discarding, forgetting information that controverts it. And it is such an unbelievably powerful bias. I mean, without a doubt, there's some of it in my book, which is ironic. A lot of the book is kind of meta that way. It's, you know, a book about overthinking written by an overthinker. I'm just really trying to work through this like everyone else. But yeah, confirmation bias is so, so fascinating to see how it emerges in the context of research, but also morality. And I remember while researching that chapter, I read this incredible psychology book called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, by mental health experts, Elliot Aronson and Carol Tavris. And that's all about confirmation bias and cognitive dissonance. And I sort of decided to recontextualize some of these studies about confirmation bias in a sort of more intimate and zeitgeisty context.
Uh-huh. Cool. Yeah. And another one that I know I am susceptible to is the recency illusion, this addiction to wanting to know the news, you know, what's new, what's novelty, what's happening.
Yes.
Boy, I'd love to shake that off, but I think we have a responsibility as a citizen to know what's going on. So there's I'm a little conflicted about that.
Yeah, conflict, feeling conflicted, that's like a main theme of this book. And it's something that I myself am always learning to tolerate and navigate. But yeah, the recency illusion describes this proclivity to think that something is new and thus urgent and worthy of panic just because it's new to you. Right. So, you know, you can imagine a time when that was really useful. Say, if you're living, you know, in the Neolithic period, I would not trade the present for the Neolithic period, I'll tell you that. If you were living back then and you heard a rustling in the bushes, it was fair to assume that even if the cause of that rustling had been sitting there all afternoon, the fact that it was claiming your attention in that moment signified that was then a relevant stimulus that could potentially be a danger to you, that now that thing, whether it was a predator or whatever, was potentially on the move and could harm you. But again, not unlike the halo effect and so many of these other biases, we are now applying that once very useful survival mechanism to the news, clickbait headlines, and of course, media companies are incentivized to make objectively non-urgent, non-threats seem perilous and new and urgent. And so, yeah, I too am reckoning with the of course civic responsibility to remain aware of what's going on in our communities and in the world, and at the same time sort of not allow my nervous system to fall prey to an exploitation of the recency illusion.
Right, which mainly flows through the headlines. These people that write headlines, they should be spanked, you know, with all the negativity bias that they have and the alarmist attitude. You know, you listen to the news on TV, it's so alarmist. I don't do that anymore because they bring such a tone to it. Everything's such a big deal all the time. You know, I came up with a magical thinking concept that I wanted to run by you, and I didn't see it in your book, but I'd say it's the magical thinking of a great idea. And what I've noticed, I was an entrepreneur, and I've advised a lot of entrepreneurs, and people have a great idea, you know, and it's like they think, oh, this thing can't lose, you know, it's just the greatest idea ever. And so I've gotten into sort of lecturing people, well, you know, a great idea isn't worth that much. I mean, if you can bring some skills to bear, you know, like marketing or development or, you know, financial management, you know, if you have resourcefulness and determination and good luck, it could turn out, but a great idea is not. So I ask people, if you had a great idea, you were sure it couldn't lose, but all you needed was enough money to get it off the runway, so you're looking for investors, what percentage of the company would you want to retain? And everybody has the same answer. Oh, at least 51%.
Yeah.
And I learned a long time ago from a mentor of mine, said, wrong. If you can get 49%, jump on it, because a great idea is worth 10 to 25%, depending on whether you're a celebrity or not. It's sort of like an author writes a book. That's a great idea. There's a lot of content there. They're going to get a 10% royalty. So that's, you know, the reward for having a great idea. So I think people overestimate the value of their ideas and they go off half-cocked.
Yeah. I do address a similar subject matter a little bit in a very humbling chapter called The Scammer Within, where I address overconfidence bias, which also which describes, you know, unfortunately, a pretty universal tendency to overcredit ourselves with positive outcomes and, you know, assume the best in ourselves in all these different ways. And I went into that chapter thinking, like, surely overconfidence bias can't apply to me. I'm a reasonable person who hates themselves. But indeed, I then realized that overconfidence is a double-edged sword, because on one hand, you know, it's what helps us collaborate. Like, the fact that we sometimes mistake other people's expertise for our own, those fuzzy cognitive brain barriers, they really pave the way for collaboration. You know, when we overreach ourselves, it lends itself to progress, to, you know, getting in groups and really, like, harnessing everyone's expertise in a sort of mind melded type of way that can really lead to a lot of greatness. But at the same time, overconfidence can lead to catastrophic, you know, technological disasters, lawsuits, you know, speaking of business, you name it. So yeah, a lot of these cognitive biases come with pros and cons, and being able to recognize them in myself and in other people has really provided me with a lot of healing and humility.
Okay, so you have a lot to say about positive thinking, and I don't think you have the phrase law of attraction in your book, but I think that's what you're commenting on with this whole manifestation thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what about positive thinking? It seems like, you know, it's kind of hard to argue with that.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, developing an optimism practice is endorsed by so many mental health experts, including those that I spoke to for this book. But when you kind of make this absolutist misattribution of cause and effect by saying, if you think positively enough, then surely you won't get cancer or something like that, that's pretty problematic. Or when, you know, a sort of self-interested manifestation guru type advertising online will say, you know, I have a sort of bespoke manifestation, like, proprietary technique, and if you pay me $30 a month, then you can learn it. And if it doesn't work for you, well, that's your fault. And there's a lot of sort of victim blaming implications that can come along with that. And at the very same time, like, these two truths are I try to hold them in my hands at the same time. But, you know, absolutely, like, even if positive thinking will not prevent you from contracting a disease or misfortune due to random bad luck or systemic issues or something, it certainly will help you feel better along the way. And there's value there for sure.
Right, right. That's true. And what about the sunk cost fallacy? What's wrong with that? You know, sort of like, okay, well, people have invested so much of their time, energy, or money into something, then they can't let go of it. That's the basis of it, right?
Yeah. It's our tendency to think that resources already spent on an endeavor, time, money, but also emotional resources like hope or secrets, justify spending even more. And the sunk cost fallacy is often discussed in the context of economics. But in this book, I have a chapter where I get up close and personal, divulging the story of a romantic relationship that I was in that I doubled down on and stayed in for many, many, many of my formative years beyond what made sense to anyone else or even myself. It was a relationship that really did not serve me, and I knew that logically, and yet the sunk cost fallacy really motivated me to, you know, dig my heels in. And whenever, you know, we were experiencing our worst moments, I would post the happiest looking photos of us online. And, you know, I would try to add variables to the equation to make the relationship better instead of sort of taking stock and accepting that I had made a bad bet on myself. But yeah, the sunk cost fallacy is a key motivator behind so many behaviors, high stakes and low stakes.
Well, we're coming close to running out of time, and I want to share something that you wrote towards the end of the book. Learning to stomach a sense of irresolution, and I would say that's acceptance of uncertainty, might be the only way to survive this crisis. That is precisely what this exploration of cognitive biases has helped me do. This is you speaking to the reader. I want to ask you, what do you think an unbiased mind would be like? Do you have any concept of, is that even possible?
No, absolutely not. I don't think it's even possible. It's not even possible for AI, you know? Like, it is truly, like, not something that I expect we'll see. But I would imagine that an unbiased mind might not have very much personality.
Might not have much to talk about.
But no.
Well, you know, there's, yeah, I mean, I think there's this constant struggle for those of us who are dedicated to truth or to understanding things better. There's this struggle between our biases and our desire for truth. And we have to have some kind of humility about it, it seems to me. You know, sort of like one of the things I write in my book is that I always question every belief that I carry with the question, why might my ego want to believe this? You know, and often I'll come up with a reason my ego would want to believe that, and that immediately sheds some doubt on the proposition. So I have to look at it a little bit harder rather than just clinging to whatever my ego wants to be right about in the moment. So
yeah,
anyway,
I like that exercise.
I want to thank you so much for being on the show. It's been fascinating in the short time that we have, and your book is great. I want to recommend it to all of our readers.
Thank you.
To that in a second. There's so much more that you and I could talk about, but we've run out of time. So I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, where they can find out about your work and more stuff about you. And that's amandamontel.com. Amanda Montel, it's all one word, M-O-N-T-E-L-L. Now, for those who may have tuned into Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, you can play and or share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Amanda Montel, author of The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm every Sunday morning at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. But even better, podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to anytime you want and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. That's divination.com, as well as via iTunes, Paulo's YouTube channel, and other free podcast servers. Now remember to help KBOO reach our membership drive goal by showing your support today at kboo.fm/give or by texting the letters KBOO to the number 44321. Every donation helps keep KBOO on the air to bring you programming like Pathways. 80% of KBOO's budget comes from listeners like you, so please consider becoming a sustaining member and supporting independent community radio. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcasts. And I would encourage you to bring it to pick up this book, The Age of Magical Overthinking. And thanks again to Amanda Montell.
Postmodern, a reaction against the ideas and values of modernism. Avant-garde, new, unusual, and experimental ideas. KBOO, a community radio station that supports both. Join us in our mission.